Hello and welcome back to the 1895 podcast. Once again, I'm Thomas D. Now, if you listened to last week's podcast, you would have heard the first half of our live Make Hydrogen Happen panel at our event in London. If you haven't heard that yet, then please do go back and have a listen. That episode's gone down very well, so as promised, today we bring you the second half of that live panel debate. So without further ado, it's back over to Rob and the rest of his panel.
Okay, I'd actually like to come back to you for a moment, Martina, if we may. We've talked at a fairly high level or broad level on some of these discussion points. You know all about grids, off-grid, microgrids. You're an innovator. You've got actually shovels in the ground. You're making it happen and you're proving the business case. So do you think we need more of that? I mean, you've kind of alluded to this already, but do you think we need to actually get more smaller scale projects done, the proving ground?
Yes, obviously, since that's what I do 24/7. But from a very practical, again, and I'm quite surprised by the fact that many of the big boys, if you like, are very forthcoming in actually doing that together. And sometimes, if you are in a tendering situation, and if the tender who's submitting the tender isn't as skilled in your field, there is an opportunity to really work together if you have an open mind and if you allow yourself to do that. So I'm quite surprised that we are, as an example, can provide local production of hydrogen for research and development for the big guys, because they do not have the knowledge within the company. So it is happening, but I shouldn't frown upon small, again, and it's very ludicrous if you look at me, small being beautiful, because I'm absolutely huge. But if you, I don't think you should frown upon it. I think that you should know that there is money available, but we need to make sure that money is long-term. Because many of these, like friends in the industry, like you said earlier on, Raven, has run to the stock market, and I don't think that was very wise, because they are now fighting a quarterly economy, and it's something else when it comes to administration and feeding, you know. So all of you who have ready money, long-term money available, do utilize it, because it's needed.
Thank you, and I'm going to come to you as well, Raven. I mean, you've already been very complimentary about, you know, Martina's approach and what they've been doing. I know that you interview, again, on the electric side, on your podcast, you interview small startups that have made a difference and are proving it. So presumably you feel this way as well.
Oh, absolutely. I think, I'll give you an example, Rob. It's a great question, small scale versus large scale. Look at Indonesia. Right, 2,000 islands over 2,000 kilometers. What an immense geography. The oil is in Java and Sumatra, and then it's processed in Kalimantan and then sent in ships to all of these islands from Borneo to Papua New Guinea, where then it's used as diesel to make energy, because energy is free for them because it comes from the islands. Along the way, you have pilferage, and you've got all this immense amount of hydrocarbons that you're pumping into the atmosphere. Now, small little islands with a village of 2,000 people can go off-grid, and you could do a use case today, and it would be cheaper than diesel. It would. At $9 a kg of hydrogen, it would be cheaper than diesel, because you have to look at the whole of life cost of diesel, from the drilling the hole, processing it, putting it on a ship, the pilferage, the stealing, the safety, the storage, the use, and then the emissions, right? When you look at that, it's already cheaper. So I think small scale has a fantastic opportunity today in places like that. And there's many places like Indonesia. You can think of Rwanda, you can think of all sorts of places where getting a power line to you is going to be so incredibly expensive. You can think of the borders of India with Tibet, where you have similar problems. Big mountain ranges, and you've got a real electricity all the way. And it comes by helicopter, diesel by helicopter. I truly think that you've got a use case for small scale off-grid green hydrogen generation from whatever technology, waves in the Faroe Islands or in the Shetland Islands or, wind or solar. But I think your question had another part, which is, do small scale companies make a difference? And the truth is they always do. And the big risk for them is how long can you be dissonant in the industry before you either run out of steam or get bought out, right? And all of the changes that you're seeing in the hydrogen industry today has come from startups that are pushing it. The big end of town has gotten in 10 years later. It's the startups that always make a difference. And so, it's a hats off to the people who fund them as angels. Nine out of 10 die, but the ones who survive make the big difference. I wanted to just close on two comments from the previous section. Martin, you talked about very strong comments online about hydrogen. I actually enjoy when that happens because now you're having a religion forming. You talked about the church of hydrogen being a big church. When you start getting strong views, it means that you're starting to make people uncomfortable, and those are typical, they usually would be diesel heads and petrol heads who know only one way to do things. And if people are starting to be uncomfortable, it means you're making a difference. So that's a very good thing. The second question was, do you want to have a top-down planned economy approach and have a carbon tax? And I reckon if you're going to have a planned economy approach like the Chinese, make sure you got it right, because if you got it wrong, it's going to be very expensive. The Chinese decided in 2014, stop all lead-acid manufacturing of batteries, move to lithium way before lithium was cheap. They got that right. They decided they want to be in hydrogen. They got that right. But what the Chinese do is make sure that they are economical when they sell it overseas. And that comes from the whole structuring of the economy. Land is cheaper, labor is cheaper, access to minerals is cheaper, plus you get subsidies, taxation is cheaper. If you put a carbon tax, we become uneconomical in some ways for the other things we're doing, and that then creates the bigger geopolitical situation that we have. So I wanted to add those two comments to the question, so forgive me for imposing on that.
No, that's fantastic. Thank you. A many splintered answer. If it's not too simplistic, do we also need to see the same on refueling and infrastructure? So we're talking about production there, but what about the refueling side? We have a huge lack of it here in the UK, for example. I feel like I've been moaning about that for about a decade, but also globally in relative terms, we still need to build that out. So again, without oversimplifying this, how do we break this impasse? David, should we come to you?
So I think the question on starting small, you have to start small. And whether it's a demonstration. So in general, we start with one and then we build from there. And I think there is this need, of course, for the generation of hydrogen, the distribution of hydrogen, and the use of hydrogen. So you need this three-legged stool. And in every case, we start with one and we build. I like to tell the story of how LNG developed in Europe. Because I've been with Westport now 4 years. And when I joined the company, there were about 100 some LNG stations in Europe. And now there's more than 600. And so I think there's a parallel there that's useful as we talk about how do we build out hydrogen and what should we do. And it started in northern Spain with a few stations and a few trucks, and then it built out from there. And so I do think the whole process of having a demonstration fleet, a demonstration refueling site, a demonstration generation site, coupling them all together, the teamwork, the collaboration, and then build from there. Because frankly, in most cases, and we touched on it earlier, but I wanted to come back to it, our politicians do not understand what we understand. We have to teach them. They're politicians. They're not engineers and chemists. So we need to teach them. And the best way to teach even a child anything is to show them, demonstrate to them. And these tend to be very expensive things when we do them at scale. So better to start small and show success small and then build from there. And so I think that is the path. And we need to come together and make a plan. And then we can do that. And we can do that without the government. Better do it with the government, but step by step, we have to do both things.
Sure, thanks, David. Michaela or Celia, I can see you making some notes there.
I'd just like to come back on the islands issue with hydrogen and fuel cells, because it's a great example of decentralized power, which I think that's where hydrogen really demonstrates commercial application, and really that's. Also around energy security, and that's something we haven't really talked about today, and that's a critical issue right now about energy security. We've kind of touched on it, but it's absolutely critical, and hydrogen and fuel cell technologies and manufacturing those ourselves and having access is absolutely key, and we have to really consider carefully whether we want to be dependent on importing technologies and importing fuel going into the future. It doesn't sound like a great idea to me. I'd like to be making our own technologies here and our own fuels here. Wouldn't that be great? And islands are a great example of that. Mm. Britain's an island. Feels like an obvious thing to do.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Coming back to the your question around refueling infrastructure. So obviously in the UK we've had refueling stations built in the past. We've got a little bit stuck there. I think we're in a completely different place now to when that initial work was taking place. If we can maintain the momentum that we're seeing in terms of scaling up supply and those sorts of things, you know, there's so much of a better fit in terms of the use cases for that hydrogen that's being produced, particularly in transport, which is recognised as being one of the early markets. And of course, we can't have transport if we don't hydrogen for transport, if we don't have refueling. And I think there's also an element there of when we look at the transportation and storage, I have to think of my words carefully, the transportation and storage of hydrogen to move it from place to place and store it until it's needed and all those sorts of things. Obviously, we're going to need a pipeline system to do that, but we will both now and in the future need to move some of that hydrogen around via road or other modes of transport. So there's another sort of thread in there. We need to ensure that we do all of this on an equitable basis so that if we're looking at far-flung either places of use or places of production, you know, we won't have a pipeline system that goes out to them either now or in the future. And it's going to take us a while to put a pipeline system in place. So there's another thread there alongside the broader transport piece, which is around transporting hydrogen as well. So.
Sure, thank you. I also think we've perhaps stumbled on something which I just made a note, communication, awareness, understanding, training. We still have myths to bust, don't we? We still have a perception to change, clearly. And we need to make sure that in the corridors of power and everywhere that matters, that they do understand this molecule and how we handle it and use it. So just across the panel, do you think we've still got a problem with that, with communication? We're doing our bit at H2View, we're all here today, but have we got a bigger challenge ahead?
Yeah, we clearly have a problem. When you talk about hydrogen, everyone thinks immediately about the Zeppelin. And, you know, we're 110 years after the Zeppelin technology changed. The Zeppelin wasn't even about hydrogen, it was about other things that caused the explosion. But we have to deal with that. I think, you know, you look at the meat industry or the wine industry, the milk industry, the beef industry, the wool industry, how they actually came together and have this big campaign over 10 years, wine, you know, glass a day is good for you, the doctor says so, you know, the protein of beef and the protein of lamb is good for you, milk for your kids. So these are industries that came together and that globally created a movement that made the industry successful, dairy, meat, and wool. And we have that responsibility in hydrogen to do that, absolutely. We haven't come together. I'd like to see H2V as the global mouthpiece of the industry, you know, of all of the councils, the strategy committees of the associations of hydrogen across the globe. But we do need to come together to educate regulators and policymakers, because that's the first cab off the rank. That's where there's the least amount of knowledge today, because they're dealing with an oil molecule that they think they're going to deal with a hydrogen molecule. Absolutely. Communication, big key piece here that we're doing in patches. Some are doing really well, but not all.
Sure, thank you. I mean, we are trying. We'd like to see that as well. Any other responses to that on communication and awareness?
Yes. And again, I need to go to my own experience. We were three people when we trained all of the health and safety officers in Sweden. You know, done by a privately owned company who was working pro bono. That sort of sums up, you know, where we have been and what's needed. Just as an example, I'm on the board of the Swedish Hydrogen Association, which is, you know, it contains a lot of different industries, but we work together with the agencies, training and sharing knowledge so that the government can have a basis of information to tap into. Maybe that could be something that could be emulator, happy to share information on that, because I do not think that you can train enough. In Sweden, as an example, when you need a permit, it's by the local fire brigade or rescue service. So there are 290 different municipalities in Sweden. So it really is local knowledge. So there needs to be a structure of things. And again, we are having the basis from the European Commission that's pushing that now, but it's slow. It's slow. So, I mean, you can run so fast. And if you look at it as a risk assessment and you really tap into those areas that are so important for your community to work, communication, transport, security of supply, healthcare, medicines or whatever, and start with those and approach those because they are so important for everybody and people understand it. You understand it as a politician, you understand it as a grandmother, you know, in your everyday operations. So I think that risk assessment is extremely important to find those really good projects that can highlight and really educate.
Absolutely. Thank you, Martina. Michaela.
Yeah, so the thing that impresses most people about us is our hydrogen car, which is not our car. I mean, it's our car, but we don't make it. It's Toyota car. So, but yeah, showing up and demonstrating, that's what people want. And people are always impressed by it. And then you can make really interesting products. But ultimately, we've got to democratise this technology. So we have to get it out there go beyond this esteemed audience, but it's got to get out there to the public, and we have to get, you know, people buying into it literally. Mm-hmm. And nothing will convince people and investors as much as a commercial product. That's what will really lift it off. And in terms of education, we're all on a hydrogen learning curve, and whenever I meet people, I have to figure out where they are on that curve and then help them get to the next bit. And that's why it's hard at the moment. So we do probably need to lift a more general awareness. I'm not sure anybody's got that particularly right yet. So that means it's an opportunity, right? So people can get out there and just demonstrate it and show what the possibilities are.
Sure, thank you. Celia, anything?
Of course. So I guess for us, education and dialogue and influencing is absolutely a core part of our work. We are talking to the policy community on a weekly, if not regular basis. And just picking up an example we were hearing earlier about the things like certification and codes and standards and approvals and some of those sorts of things. We are working with the Regulators Forum, who've invited us to come and share some practical experience from our members. So we're going to start talking about permitting for projects, and we're going to talk about the red tape that sits around things like ships and boats and things like that, and have a series of dialogues with that group, which brings together a whole range of different people. And then at the political level, we had our first Lobby of Parliament back in January, which brought together our members with their constituency MPs. And that was a really useful opportunity for local MPs to understand and hear from businesses in their area who are creating jobs and those sorts of things that are important to MPs, and understand where hydrogen and its applications fits into that. As everybody has said, there's a huge and likely to be growing challenge opportunity to engage with the wider public and help them to understand what this is all about. And that's absolutely key to going forward. And I fully agree with everyone in terms of seeing, touching, kicking tyres and all those kind of good phrases is going to be really important. So there's a number of different threads to that communication piece that we need to be kind of pursuing in parallel.
Sure, thank you. And actually, Ravin, some of your examples around milk and wine, to an extent, I'd actually add battery electric to that. I think, that certainly from my experience in this country, for a period, it felt like there was a whole machine behind that on radio adverts, TV adverts. And of course, when you've got some of that proving ground, you see the stations at the supermarkets or in car parks, it becomes familiar. And people think, oh, hey, that's just what I turn the light on with, so I can do that as well. So I would add that to that list. Still a long way to go for them, but they have a significant head start, I think, on hydrogen awareness. I'm conscious we want the opportunity for some final questions from the floor, so just one more from me for my book. I'm actually going to turn right to you, Karina. You obviously draw upon Gasworld Business Intelligence's very historic database of traditional merchant hydrogen and that kind of bigger picture view. And I know you've done a lot of study on the new side of hydrogen. So in light of the Inflation Reduction Act in the US, for example, which we've talked a lot about already, how does your analysis at Gasworld HGView see the US and European hydrogen movements compare? How do you see this evolving on that supply and demand side?
So I would say if we compare to all these geographies, there are more differences than similarities. So first of all, each region has different structure of economy. So US has quite strong chemistry, refining, electronics, and this is where hydrogen mostly. And in Europe, this is here are what we name general manufacturing, and chemistry quite strong. So this is regarding traditional demand. If we move towards the new applications, and first of all to mobility, here are also quite a big difference. US has quite developed material handling applications. They started ages ago, and now they have already quite big demand for hydrogen on this area. Mm-hmm. And also hydrogen cars already in US are already much more developed. Say, if we think about figures, in the US, it was the US fleet, something about 14,000 cars. Here in Europe, altogether, something about 5,000. Both are quite small, but anyway. If we look at trains, so here is Europe ahead. So Germany already has, as I remember, 14 hydrogen trains working, and several other countries either testing or thinking about it. US is far from this, so they just thinking. Yeah, and also what else? Trucks and buses. Here are Europe, surprisingly higher, has higher, larger number. Mm-hmm. So if we speak about the demand in the total volume of demand, Europe is probably several times slower, say. And if we look at US and in Europe in 2030, forecast-wise, we will have something like about 500 tons per day for mobility applications in US and something like 200-300 in Europe total. But it looks like Europe has a potential to develop this whole area quicker. Another difference also. In US, all this demand concentrated mostly around California, mm-hmm. and in Europe it's distributed quite mm-hmm. well. Yeah, this is it in general.
Yeah, much more evenly.
Okay.
I think the material handling side as well, whilst it's not particularly sexy, it's been a good proving ground, hasn't it, for at least a decade, maybe longer?
Yeah, I would say, you know, this is material handling. It's not just warehouses. This is also ports. And here we have quite a lot to decarbonize. Mm. So if we speak, say, about ports, half will go to lifting equipment, another half to trucks or yard trucks. Mm. Yeah, so it's quite, I think...
and you see significant opportunities around ports, don't you?
Yeah, but ports is, when we speak about ports, we speak about lifting or trucking, trucks or water vessels. But water vessels are not yet, as we understood, not yet started. No, there are some projects, some thoughts, but mostly demand will come from mobility, from road mobility and lifting. Yeah.
Sure. Thanks, Karina. I'm conscious of time and certainly for the panelists. I've had you sat here for 90 minutes already. So just a final opportunity. Are there any more questions from the floor? We've got the roving mics. Oh, I can see a couple already. Not sure who's got three or four. Who's going to win this race?
Thank you. Good afternoon. Nadia Jacquard from West Belt Fuel Systems. I'd like to come back to the refueling infrastructure topic and with a question about how do we make it happen fast enough? Because as David was saying, we have seen what happened with LNG in Europe, and there has been a pretty fast rollout of the LNG infrastructure, but if you compare with what we want and need for hydrogen, it's far from being fast enough. So we need to do things much faster than we have done them with any other transition. And one of the elements that Europe has in its policy is the Alternative Fuels Infrastructure Regulation that mandates a certain build-out of refueling infrastructure. It's something that the UK doesn't have right now, so I'm wondering if it's something missing in the UK, or if there are other elements that are needed to ensure we have this really quick transition that we need.
So I'm not sure who wants to tackle. I mean, I'm not sure you should, David.
Right.
Perhaps Celia or Michaela can answer that.
I'll start, shall I? So I guess just coming back to some earlier comments at the risk of being boring. So I think for us, it's all about a much clearer vision for how we roll out hydrogen transport in the UK. So as I said, we'd like to see a strategy in this area, a multimodal strategy, not only road transport, but other modes as well. And the ways in which we refuel those, which will, of course, connect over into hydrogen production and wider distribution and all those things. But it's a huge, huge gap. And as you said, we've got targets in Europe, not only for the rollout of hydrogen refueling infrastructure, but also numbers of vehicles. And we need that as well. And then, of course, we will need, as part of that strategy, the policy frameworks to help deliver those against those targets. Yeah, it's just a huge gap. We need to move forward on many fronts here to make that happen.
Michaela, anything to add?
Well, only that, you know, it's a fleet and back-to-base model that's going to work, and there's lots of commercial businesses looking at that, and that's moving, but coordinating that, you know, there's no coordination nationally, so that is the biggest problem, national strategy. But there are, again, regional strategies to address that. So the Midlands, I know Midlands Connect, which is dealing with all forms of transport. I mean, most things that move around the UK move through the Midlands at some point. So we, you know, we can address it in that way. And I know that there are certain sites allocated, then it's commercial businesses coming in. Is it going to be the fleet operators themselves that provide those refueling or stations, or will there be independents? So I think there will be, you know, there will be progress. But this lack of national strategy and you know, the sort of can-do spirit is missing a little bit at the moment, holding it up.
Thank you. And I think David, if we can get him a mic, has something to add as well.
Thank you. Yes, apologies for butting in. I know I'm not on the panel, but I was a technical lead for the OZEV hydrogen refueling station programme in the UK for a number of years. And it was an extremely frustrating experience, not in this case necessarily particularly because of government. It did take a long time to get things moving. But actually the problems, so the UK used to have more filling stations than it has now, because there isn't enough demand, partly because we drive on the other side of the road from a lot of people, which causes issues in terms of sourcing vehicles and in terms of standardisation. And partly because the refueling stations themselves are frankly, by and large, not fit for purpose. And I'm very sorry to have to say that. I drive a Hyundai Nexo. I have problems with my local fueling station in Switzerland relatively frequently. And this is, we run a lot of the demonstration programs across Europe. There is a significant issue in our technology. So, you need a strategy, you need it to be joined up, you need demand and supply. But at the moment, to be quite honest, the government tried that, it got burned. It was really difficult even getting the right number of bids in. So I'm not sure I have an answer to this one, but I would be cautious about pushing too hard until we're absolutely certain that it'll work this time. Because if it doesn't work again, then we really do risk setting ourselves up for a bigger problem.
Yeah, I think I'll just make one point on the forecourt operators. My understanding is it's very difficult to make that commercial model work, and some people have, you know, had difficulties. So that's another thing. So it's not just the technology development, it's also the commercial model development, isn't it? And getting that right is really a challenge.
Again, not being from the UK, but maybe if that is the case, maybe one should look at dispensers on a very different level. It can be just as interesting to have refueling stations for infra logistics, say forklifts, and a number of those that could lift it to another awareness level if you have that experience. That's one of the most common questions are being asked for us, because in a warehouse things really need to move, and if you've gone down the battery route and you still need to recharge them, that could be something that's really there is an economy in that, it may be viable. So maybe that's something you could add to it, not to go around down the same route of, I do realise, and I know from experience, we built our first off-grid production site for green hydrogen in 2018. So yes, been there, done it, and it's there is a steep learning curve, indeed, and we are, we'll see in a couple of years' time where we are.
I think Ravin's got something.
Yeah.
I think you hit the nail on the head when you said get the technology right. So I'll come at this from two perspectives. The reason that the LNG molecule took off so fast and easy was that the oil companies understood the molecule. This was a variant of the methane molecule. It was cryogenic. And cryogenics has been understood by the cryogenic industry forever, right? You already have a very, it was lower than oxygen and nitrogen in temperature, so it's very easy to have a whole ecosystem to put this in place and make it work. It was just another molecule or a variant of another molecule at the filling station. So everybody got their heads right and it was easy to do. Hydrogen, completely different. Now, the other problem we also have is it's so expensive just to get a normal filling station. LNG wasn't the case. It was very easy to get on the forecourt and say, well, I'm just going to put another bunker. Maybe it's 2 times the price. Here today, you're talking about 10, 20 times the price. And so, you're scratching the head as a decision maker going, do I want to do this? Now, who's doing this? Small little startups at the moment, maybe one or two big companies, or getting bigger. Who are their customers? There are four people, Shell, BP, Total, one other. You're not going to get funding for that because there's four people sitting in that room making a decision and they're going to tell you, I want that price. And there goes your margins. And you're wearing all the risk, not getting the cash flow, and you're not getting any margin. So you're not going to get funding in the cycle. So that means that the evolution of this technology on the forecourt is going to slow down. Finally, because they're all small companies, I'll give you an example. We had a tender in India to do 10 hydrogen buses that were going to run from Delhi to Leh. And we were trying to help because the government said, we can't get anybody interested in dispensers. The top 5 dispenser companies in Europe said, we're not interested to talk to you. Come back to us in 2026. And I thought, wow, I want to be in a business like that when I can tell my customer to come back in 2026. They're printing money in these small government-funded projects. I'm really happy in that scale, not wanting to take on geographies that present risk. So when you put all of this together, it makes it very difficult for the ecosystem to come together, and all the parts of the ecosystem that need to come together, from compressors to liquefiers, nozzles, cables, pipes. So many things need to come together to give you that safe experience you're talking about, get the tech right. And no one company does it. Every dispenser company is an integrator. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're putting together things to make this happen, so they don't really get what they're doing either.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Robin. We're back to that term ecosystem, which is so key. David, I feel like I should actually give you an opportunity to respond.
Yeah, no problem. The one thing that I'd just like to echo is really about getting the numbers right financially and making the economics work and making the affordability. I think in many cases, we have the technology. I know we're demonstrating technology. We feel very comfortable with its in production, it's in the field. Today, again, with LNG, but nonetheless, we demonstrated also that hydrogen works very well, and the economics we think work very, very well. But we need this on every step of the way, and we need it in a way, I'll come back to my base, we need the certainty. We need to know that the economics are going to play out in the long run. Just LNG example, sorry for that, but we just had high prices for natural gas over the last year because of the war in Ukraine and other factors, 6x what it's supposed to be, and this takes all the wind out of the sails. So this is a place where the government, in terms of active policy, the government could play a role in setting that table for us so that we can have the certainty, so we can make the investments, so we can make the technologies that work, we can make them affordable, and that people who are running businesses can access technology they can count on and do so affordably.
Sure, thank you. Do we still have questions in the room? Yes, at the back.
Afternoon, everyone. Thank you to the panelists. My name is Jay. I'm from Ricardo. I think the conversation has been really interesting, but I haven't heard much. I mean, I've heard a bit about India and so on, but what about Africa? And I've seen a lot of talk about potential exports from Namibia, for example, to Germany, and some Northern African countries being active in the space. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. What are the possibilities in that space? Is it actually part, or is it actually contributing to the net zero agenda if we're going to be then shipping a whole lot of things around the world, or a whole lot of fuels around the world, and you know that shipping is far from being decarbonized. Just picking your brain on that aspect. Thank you.
And I'm hoping maybe you, Martina, will pick this one up.
And thank you, Jay. That's a great question, and so viable as well. And it's happening big scale. It really is, both on the bilateral agreements. You've had that from all the way from down from South Africa all the way up to Egypt, and you know that's happening. But again, talk about decentralization and the possibility of decentralization. We've had so many questions for so many years that have been thrown our way. Unfortunately for us, the technology hasn't been ready, and we haven't had the footprint there. But it is really happening, and it's happening fast. And I think that like you said very early on in this conversation, Avenue, it's about democracy as well, and the ability to utilize the local resources. Because when you have the experience, you'll know that it isn't as difficult as one might think. Again, huge possibility for fuel cell generators, as an example, having a small scale of production for very important parts of your society. So, yes, happy to elaborate on that, over a coffee. Cheers. Thanks.
Thanks, Martina. Thanks for the question. And coffee's not too far away either. I'll reassure everyone. I think we still had a question at the back.
Hello, everyone, and thank you to the panelists for this time. I believe Gavin, I didn't quite catch your name, but you raised a point with regards to demonstrating short, small scale, first to the politicians and treat them like kids in order so that start developing things in our scale. And it's both a comment and a question, so I'll start by the comment. As Sabral Stage 2, along with our partners, we've done the hydrogen crossing in France. And for the hydrogen crossing, we started in the north of France using a hydrogen-powered bicycle and a carriage in which we had two hulls of hydrogen. And with the other partner, Verso, who is an energy provider of the future, we traveled throughout France in the space of 5 days and went with a 180-kilogram carriage, only powered through hydrogen, all the way to Marseille. And the idea behind that was to indeed show the small-scale projects and progress that we've made with regards to hydrogen and demonstrate it to the maximum amount of people in France. So people could see if like any people in small villages in France could just see a hydrogen-powered bicycle, a hydrogen-powered car following it, and not quite yet hydrogen-powered truck with the whole camera crew. But the question that comes from that is, how do we get the politicians that we talked about to quickly start investing in the technology? Because what we realized from this hydrogen crossing was that us three small-scale companies just didn't have the budget to make this work, and we had to, it was really difficult for us to take the right decisions and find the money to make this work. So how do we get the budget to start massively, properly advertising projects such as this one so people get a general sense and everyone can start seeing what we can do with hydrogen? How do we get there?
I think this is a great way, Ravin, that was mostly addressed to you, but I think actually why don't we use this as a final question for the whole panel as a wrap-up. So should we start with you, Ravin?
Yes.
It's a great question, and I think it actually touches every subject we cover today, policy, regulatory, communications.
finances. It covers everything, right? And I think we're not doing everything as an ecosystem. Everyone's doing their own thing. So I've already touched on the fact that I don't think treating politicians like kids is available, but the reality is they're only driven by the next election. So this has to become an election issue. We have to do a great job as an industry to communicate, to help educate regulators, as well as the finance industry. Very important that the finance industry gets their heads right on what is the risk of hydrogen, how do I determine risk of hydrogen as an industry, what is the risk I can take, and where are those risks in this industry? And I think we're just doing that at the EV industry was for a very long time in a disconnected manner and need to come together, and it's not going to happen tomorrow. I just want to touch on the question of Africa as well. And I remember by saying this, when I was 25, back when we had syndicated television, we could dial in, and CNN was still owned by Ted Turner, he was on the show. Rizkan from BBC had just left and joined CNN, and he was doing a phone in. And I called, and they liked my question, because my question was, hey, how come, you know, the LA Lakers score gets a full, you know, 7 minutes of the headlines and, you know, 500 people dead in an explosion in India gets 1 minute? And, you know, how do you justify that? And he said, he was quite clear in his answer, live on television to, you know, 175 countries, my advertisers are more interested in the LA Lakers. Not on 500 people dead in an explosion or 50 people dead in an explosion. And the truth is, investment and money chases the demand. And that's the reality of Africa. That's why, you know, the industrial gas industry is very small there. That's why, outside of the hydrocarbon industry, hydrogen would take some time to get there, because the demand and the ability to pay is what drives most of that investment. I know we don't like to hear it, but I'm just, you know, I was asked to be incendiary and say things like they are. I'm being brutally honest in what it is, and that's just the reality. Therefore, hydrogen will come a little bit later there than it will in the rest of the world. How can we change that? Well, I was reading in The Economist yesterday that there's another problem with electrification. It's the fact that cheap American cars are turning up in Africa. They're turning up in Burkina Faso. And now you're getting diesel cars and petrol cars that are being sold at $4,000 because they're sitting in used car lots in America, can't be sold anymore because everyone's going to electrification. Again, it comes down to policy. Your question is absolutely right. Are we just moving the pollution to some other part of the world? Yes, we are. That's absolutely what's happening. And as an industry, we need to come together and address that and address the elephant in the room to go, it's not only about the money, it's about saving the planet, right? Nobody wants to hear that. It's just a bunch of kids that'll come out and, you know, do that during the G20 or G7, and if everyone sweeps it on the table. The truth is, we have to face that.
I've forgotten the question.
I think it's a good opportunity just to round up with a final message from everyone on what we need to do next to make hydrogen happen. Let's round on that.
Yeah, we need to be long term. And you know, again, I can only have my own perspective. And for me, it was very, very apparent that because you need money, you touched upon the subject of money. And for me, it was a very deliberate decision to go for the long-term money, that they could be patient enough to be part of the journey. So because it's needed, it really is needed to be able to do this. Now, I feel very fortunate to be part of this discussion, even though I really understand the prerequisites that you are facing currently, but I can only throw in physical and actual practical experience. And you need to be versatile. You need to understand so many different things to make it happen out in reality, so that you could have the lovely fuel cell cars running, so that people want to visit and see and to be tangible. We need to work together, really need to work together. And I don't think it's not possible to just chase people and you know, bang their heads together and say, you know, you need to understand this. They need to feel it, and they need to be part of that. So we need to be long term and help each other, and to be generous and help each other as much as we can, because this is viable. We can actually decarbonize to a great extent if we are determined enough to do it. So that would be a soft, squishy roundup.
Cheers. Thank you, Martina.
So, speaking about hydrogen, we actually speak about decarbonization first of all. So, we are trying to prevent this whole global warming and all consequences which are expected to be happened. And hydrogen is just a part of all system which should be developed to, you know, to survive in some further, you know, hundreds years. And so what is it? Quite a lot should be decarbonized, and the gas industry where we work also quite, I would say, it's green. We speak about green hydrogen, but do we speak about green oxygen and green nitrogen and so on? And also, what about, you know, if we're trying to produce energy in a renewable way, how to make this energy being produced not just, you know, when sun is shining or wind, or but produce it decades, during decades, without any interruptions, to be able to supply all these large industries. So this is, I would say, this is the main problem. And this is, and hydrogen just a part of the chain. So this is my final.
I think that's a very good point, Karina. And certainly we do need to see green air gases in the gas industry, as you said, and plugging in more to the renewables for quite an energy-intensive industry. David, over to you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Just to wrap up, I'd like to bring in a term maybe from another part of our world, diversity and inclusion. So I bring this in, sure we have a lovely panel with some diversity and inclusion on the panel for sure, but I really mean about diversity of solutions, diversity of technologies, and inclusiveness. So sometimes we think, and I've heard, and you may have experienced, hey, it's all battery electric. Why are you even bothering with hydrogen? Just do battery electric. And some hydrogen guys will say, oh, it's all hydrogen, just do hydrogen. And I think this is all fallacy. It's not any one thing. And you can see it today. So I'm a transportation guy. And in the world of transportation today, we have a diversity of solutions already. And it's only going to get more diverse. And if we can build through policy with our regulators, with the people that we elect to make the rules for us, if we can make those rules that incentivize us to get to where we want to be with low carbon for our Earth, in an economic way, everything will happen almost automatically. But we do need the collaboration that comes from the diversity and inclusion that comes together so we can work on all these elements and make our contributions. So thanks for the chance today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Good points by everybody. So I think this technology and the hydrogen economy is obvious and inevitable. And I think that that's where we're going to end up. So the faster we start, the faster we'll get there. And I think sometimes it is surprising how we develop these technologies. Develop. People don't sit in rooms and make strategies that work. We have to adapt, and I think that's part of it. One thing that I always mention at the in talks is that most people don't recognise that the Apollo space missions were powered by a British fuel cell. Mm-hmm. It's a very little known fact. Everybody should be telling everybody else that. Because, and it wasn't because the developer, Francis Bacon, set out to fly to the moon. It was because he just knew that this technology was useful. You can look at mobile phones as well as another technology that was just useful. And then, but nobody predicted that we were going to be watching films on our phones or having our calendars on our phones. So the trajectory of these technologies is very unpredictable, but you have to start and you have to get it into people's hands, and then you can see where the market goes. So that's what I would really, really push for. And politicians are part of that. They're not essential, I would say. but they're useful, and I would encourage them to get involved. And personally, involving those politicians is a complicated, very meandering road. But we've been going to politicians since the mid-90s and telling them, and eventually they will support it, I'm sure. And some do along the way. Certainly there have been some significant supporters along the way. That's my final point.
Thanks. So I was thinking about the last question, actually, and I thought, I think this relates to one of my three C's, which was collaboration. And then, of course, our various colleagues have referenced that. So I think that's what I'd like to put on the table as my last point, very much reflecting on colleagues' comments here, in that collaboration within industry, we get a louder voice, we get more impact in terms of getting the message across, getting policy changed, getting the right frameworks in place to make industry grow and flourish, collaboration between industry and government so that industry understands government's constraints and vice versa. Collaboration between the industry and players outside the industry, whether it's insurers, financiers, regulators, etc. So I think communication and collaboration are absolutely key to this. It's by working together that we will succeed, we will bring costs down, and we will get to where we want to go with hydrogen. Thank you.
Fantastic, thank you. And I'm delighted to say that concludes H2View's first ever Make Hydrogen Happen panel. You, as a reminder, you've been listening to Celia Greaves from the UK Hydrogen and Fuel Cell Association, Dr. Michaela Kendall from Adelan, David Johnson from Westport Fuel Systems, Martina Wettin from Nielsen Energy, and Ravin Merchandani from the Adore Group. And on that note, can I please ask for a round of applause for all of our panellists, please? And with that, we're just one minor hiccup there. We are done. I'm delighted to say that we'll be bringing this, packing up the stage and taking it to KL in Malaysia on Friday the 8th of December, I think, when we will once again reprise this panel with, I'm sure, a range of different speakers for that region. And we'll be delighted to see you there. And I said coffee wasn't far away, so please do go make the most of the refreshments. Thank you.